Kia ora ana, you're with Dateline Pacific. Ko Toku Ingoa, ko Johnny Blades, coming up.
It should have been discussed publicly and allow submissions.
Tonga's government unmoved by criticism of a constitutional amendment.
But in terms of nuclear weapons and nuclear disarmament, we should be there in the forefront.
The Pacific, instrumental in a treaty banning nuclear weapons that's coming into force.
Something to give them a push, something to give them a start.
And Bougainville's new president talks about getting the youth into business. The acting Justice Minister in Tonga is not about to undo a constitutional amendment, despite it coming in for heavy criticism in the kingdom. The Parliament this month voted unanimously to pass Clause 89A, amending Tonga's constitution to have judges take account of custom and tradition, as well as culture, in their court rulings. But the move has drawn significant fire, as Don Wiseman reports.
The Tongan Law Society says Parliament should not have passed the constitutional reform without first referring it to public consultation. Law Society President Sione Fanua says it should have been vetted by the public and by organisations such as his, because the issue is very complex.
The implication of something that's used to somebody's advantage, using the culture, it's a very serious issue. That's why we were concerned, and it should have been discussed publicly and allow submissions and discussion before it's become enacted.
But the acting Justice Minister, Samiu Vaipulu, is adamant Parliament did the right thing. He says they were advised by the Attorney General's office that public consultation wasn't needed.
And we all looked at it with the Parliamentary Legislation Committee, and we had the feeling that there's nothing to take to the public, because there's no legislation changes at all.
Another key group upset by the change was the Women and Children Crisis Centre in Tonga. Its director, Ofakilavuka Gutenbaal Likiliki, says they're gravely concerned. She says rape, sexual assault and domestic violence cases could be hijacked by so-called traditions and practices.
All the hard work that we have been doing lobbying for the Family Protection Act, we're currently lobbying for an amendment to the rape laws under the definition of rape. We're lobbying for and advocating for sexual harassment policy throughout public service, the government. And then just to have something like this come out of the blue, I think is really disappointing that Parliament didn't take due diligence to check, you know, and have public consultation, because this is such a huge constitutional amendment.
Ms. Gutenbaal Likiliki wonders how it might impact on their work combating sexual and domestic violence.
How is this defined? Is the taking of pigs and traditional mat to apologise to the victim's family, is that going to be considered a traditional practice and value, and therefore undermine the woman's access to justice by reducing the penalties that the perpetrator could face in a sentencing?
But Mr. Vaipulu dismisses this concern, saying both sides in any legal argument would have to agree to its use in a trial.
It depends on the both parties whether they agree to use this system we are doing. It's not for one side only. Both parties, a case will be handled accordingly. It doesn't change anything.
The Law Society says there is already talk of political candidates being able to treat voters after the amendment. Sione Fanua wonders whether prospective MPs could treat voters to cover, defending it as an expression of culture.
We have already talked about allowing the candidate to donate some sort of cover and also other things that they consider is a part of our culture when you are going campaigning. So it's not an easy issue. Are you allowed to do that? Does it mean that you are buying the vote?
But Samiu Vaipulu doubts this could be an issue. He says he's been a politician since 1987, and every election has involved providing kava to potential voters. And this is documented in financial returns sent in to the electoral office. Gordon Wiseman, 10A.
Pacific Island countries have played a key role in making the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons come into force. Last week, the treaty reached its 50th ratification at the United Nations, paving the way for nuclear weapons to be deemed illegal under international law. 10 of the 50 countries who ratified the treaty are Pacific Island nations. Yet there's a lot of other countries who haven't ratified it, and that includes the 9 declared nuclear weapon states who possess most of the world's nukes. Fijian academic Vanessa Griffin is a member of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. I asked her about the significance of the treaty coming into effect.
In 90 days, it will be illegal to possess and so on and have nuclear weapons and all the things around their production. And, you know, that has been declared part of international law now that these weapons are illegal. Even if you say, look, this treaty we will not ever take part in, we don't agree with it, it is not what we wish, you still possess weapons that are now illegal and prohibited. They're banned.
So can you rock up to the United States and say, well, you're breaking international law, we're going to take you to some court, there's going to be some legal avenue?
No, I don't think that really is the process or intention. The possessors of those weapons, the users of it, disagree and say they will not take part. But over time, you basically are working in an environment of possessing and intending to use banned illegal weapons under international law. So the idea is over time, you're holding weapons that are held in great disregard and are illegal. So even investments in them, that changes many banks or superannuation funds. You have a whole part of the campaign which is about the money that goes into nuclear weapons. And do you, after these weapons are banned, want to be a fund funding the further development of banned, you know, weapons? So things like that contribute to, actually, it's the delegitimizing. They are illegitimate weapons now, or in 90 days' time. And for the countries possessing them, you know, that's what you have. You have those. You can respond in whatever ways you want. But the change is that there's now a norm saying these are illegal. There was not a norm saying those were illegal until you had the treaty. And then now when it comes into force, that is actually, yes, part of international law. These are illegal weapons under international law.
Pacific Island countries have played a key part in this treaty, haven't they? As indeed they have throughout the anti-nuclear movement.
They have indeed. And there was a huge movement against nuclear testing, and that went on for decades. And it also was about the independence of Pacific states, you know, feeling that we were territories or colonies and used. And then, you know, I often say this, even when I speak, that we did that for 30 years. And in fact, the tests stopped when France wanted to stop its last test. And the damage is still there and so on. And what I feel is our Pacific independent countries have really come forward and used their position as states in the United Nations to support this process of then approach to banning the weapons. And they did play an important part. And I should say one can be very proud that 10 Pacific region states were part of the ratification that allowed this treaty to come into force. And the last, you know, literally in the last 3 names, there is Nauru, which ratified, and before that Tuvalu ratified just a few weeks ago, and before that you had all the other Pacific states coming forward. The ratifications. So they have indeed played an important role. And many of the campaigners, including in ICANN, have, you know, paid tribute to the many states around the world, from Latin America and the Caribbean, from the Pacific, you know, from Asia, all the other countries they point out helped contribute to the treaty coming into force. We must pay tribute to the model and that New Zealand has presented to the world itself. I do recall when I joined ICANN, there was a resolution led by New Zealand, and literally that was my first lobbying experience within ICANN, that it was supporting, we must begin process of negotiating a treaty. So, you know, great tribute to New Zealand as well.
Why haven't the rest of Pacific Island countries signed on yet? Some of the big Pacific Island countries, Papua New Guinea and Solomon Islands.
There's sometimes reasons. I'm often sympathetic to the many issues Pacific states are dealing with, and they are Even if they're large countries, they often are small states in terms of their personnel. But we have, just in September, I'm very pleased to say the Young Soul Borrow, the Pacific Network, a youth network, and MISA for the Pacific, the Pacific Island Students Association, they really did a particular drive to get the last remaining Pacific states to ratify. And I do think that was influential as well, and it was new for them to approach our Pacific countries urging ratification. So I think our urging of the other Pacific states to ratify, and in fact all other states in the world that haven't, is still an ongoing process, that we don't just stop with 50. You actually want to show how many countries really do want this ban to come into effect. So I see we do have a few more Pacific countries, but I think we can work on them and get them to join.
There are few parts of the world who have been as affected by nuclear testing as the Pacific Islands, right?
Yes, that is of quite significance of how victim assistance and environmental remediation, Article 6, could then be a new means of looking at the Pacific's experience of nuclear testing. And how states now, I think, can act collectively to look at how victim assistance and environmental remediation may be implemented under this treaty, and how Pacific states can benefit from that or collectively make contributions based on their experience. Because the environmental risk of the Runet Dome and the Marshall Islands is actually now and continuing. And then I'm always concerned about Maui Nui, French Polynesia, which is still a colony of France. It's an occupied area. How does its 30 years of nuclear testing, how are they going to be affected by the treaty, and how can its content help? I know they also, you know, support this international legal instrument, because it makes a statement about nuclear weapons. You're absolutely right. And that was something even I could reflect on when I'd, you know, sort of come back after many years of break to have the world looking at nuclear weapons and their banning. I just, you know, had this moment of seeing our part of the world and how much we contributed without our wishes or will to the development of those weapons. And that's been part of the message to Pacific states when we were lobbying them, that really we may seem small as states and have always taken that position of feeling we are small, insignificant states, but in terms of nuclear weapons and nuclear disarmament, we should absolutely be there in the forefront of even the actions now in implementing this treaty, because we have an experience that is unfortunately unique. We are the only territory, or surely, where the sea is involved.
That's Vanessa Griffin of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. Bougainville's new president, Ismail Toroama, wants his region's youth involved in growing its economy. Mr. Toroama is aiming to develop small to medium enterprises in the autonomous Papua New Guinea region and hopes some of them will be run by the region's young. President Toroama is encouraging youth to use their innovative abilities to find meaningful solutions to problems at all levels of Bougainville society. Skills training and small grants are going to be made available, as he explained to Don Wiseman.
It's been 20 years that we have been traveling this long political road. But as for the young people, firstly, they have to be encouraged through workshops, through trainings. And then when they go through trainings, then they could identify themselves as what sort of activity they would like to continue from there. Some of these young people, they are cocoa growers, of course, and a little bit of training that would be given to them, it will be a great help for them to explore what road they would like to follow. And in terms of business, they have to choose. And since Bougainville is coming out from this post-conflict situation into 20 years, desire for most of the youths are to participate meaningfully. And that's why we have to open doors for them. Sometimes we say youths for tomorrow. At the same time, it's like putting a stop or a halt onto their desires. So youths for today, for tomorrow, that will bring greater change. And they will be as well part of the community meaningfully in all aspects of life.
In terms of that training that you're talking about, is that all in place, that's ready to be provided?
We have places that they could attend, especially during their communities, you know, their community groups, their church groups and women's groups and other groups that they facilitate. At the same time, when government wanted to facilitate all these sort of activities, you know, that would be a great help to them.
And you're talking about giving them small grants to get going.
Yes, that is one of those new pathways which I would like to explore. It's sort of encouraging them. It's not a big grant, but at least something to give them a push, something to give them a start which they can help in contributing meaningfully in their communities. And my government wishes to create that help. It's not big, but it's at least something that they could start on with.
This time last year, you were manager of a rock band touring the country, touring the region. If a band came to you and said, look, we need money to record and stuff like that, would you consider something as left field as that?
Yes, when I was a manager, I took all these young blokes aside and then used my own capacity into growing them. And I see them, they've grown, and some of them has become successful, not really that successful, but, you know, coming up with a start. If only we could facilitate this sort of activity just to start them off, I think it would be a much greater help for them. And they would expand as they continue.
That's Bougainville's new president, Ishmael Torawama, ending this edition of Dateline Pacific. You can check out this or any other edition of Dateline on our website, rnzi.com, or Spotify or iTunes. Till next time, tōwhā.